been a while since we've had a biographical sketch. And I think that the last one we did, I may be wrong, but I think the last one we did was about the prolific hymn writer Fanny Crosby. And I have another biographical sketch for you this afternoon. And it's about another hymn writer. So here are a few opening stanzas. Sometimes a light surprises the Christian while he sings. It is the Lord who rises with healing in his wings. When comforts are declining, he grants the soul again a season of clear shining to cheer it after rain. You know? Yeah. And this one, God moves in a mysterious way his wonders to perform. He plants his footsteps in the sea and rides upon the storm. Or what about Jesus, where'er thy people meet, there they behold thy mercy seat. Where'er they seek thee, thou art found, and every place is hallowed ground. All of those are under hymn book. We sing all those. Okay. What about this one? There is a fountain filled with blood drawn from Emmanuel's veins, and sinners plunge beneath that flood, lose all their guilty stains. Well, the writer of all those hymns was William Cowper, C-O-W-P-E-R. It looks like Cowper, but he pronounced his name Cooper, William Cowper. And you might be tempted to think that a man who could write hymns like that had it all together. But William Cowper had a hellish life, really, a life full of personal anguish. He was an Englishman born in 1731 in a town of about 1500, not far from London, and he died in 1800. So that makes him a contemporary of John Wesley and George Whitefield. Those were the leaders of the English evangelical revival in England. Cowper embraced Whitefield's Calvinistic theology instead of Wesley's Arminianism. He reminisced about being a child and seeing people come out at 4 o'clock in the morning to try to get there so that they could hear George Whitefield's preaching in an open field. They wanted to get a good place so they could hear Whitefield preach. To help us understand the era that he lived in, here are some time markers. He was 27 years old. William Cowper was 27 years old when Jonathan Edwards died over in America. He lived through both the American and the French revolutions. His poetry was known by Benjamin Franklin. And Benjamin Franklin, who you know is a publisher, gave Cowper's first volume of poetry a very favorable review. William Cowper's father was a chaplain to King George II, but they were not evangelical, and William was not converted to Christianity until much later in his life, in adulthood. And though his father was a clergyman, some of the things I read about him make me believe he was a horrible father and not a wise man at all. Actually, maybe not a good man. William Cowper's mother died when he was 6, and his father sent him to Pitman's boarding school in Bedfordshire at 6 years old. And from Cowper's testimony later in his life, we know that this was a tragic mistake. He was known to be a shy and sensitive child, and he was treated cruelly in school and had many painful experiences while there. He hated the boarding school and he longed for his father. If you read some of C.S. Lewis' experience in English boarding schools, God help us. Later in his life, Cowper wrote, "My chief affliction consisted in my being singled out." He was there from 6 to 10. "From all the other boys by a lad of about 15 years old as a proper object upon which he might let loose the cruelty of his temper. I choose to forbear a particular recital of the many acts of his barbarity with me, which he made it his business continually to persecute me. I take it sufficient to say that he had, by his savage treatment of me, impressed such a dread of his figure upon my mind that I may well remember being afraid to lift my eyes upon him higher than his knees. I knew him by his shoe buckles better than any other part of his dress. May the Lord pardon him, and may we meet in glory. So he wrote that much later. So, a hell for a child. From the age of 10 until he was 17, he attended the Westminster Private School, and he learned French, Latin, and Greek well enough to spend about the last 50 years of his life translating Homer and Horace and Madame Guyon into English. At the age of 18, he went to study law. He didn't like it, and he never practiced law. He fell in love with a cousin, and she became a muse for much of his poetry. And she loved him, and he loved her. His father did not approve, and neither William nor the cousin ever married. The later, she was quite wealthy and sent him money to help him, and they remained friends. Now, it's difficult to do transgenerational psychological analysis. But clearly, his own personality and his early life experiences dramatically affected William Cooper. He lost his mother very early, and his relationship with his father was never good. I mentioned that he never practiced law, but after his training, he was offered a government position. But it required that he pass an examination. And he became so panicked and worked up at having to answer questions that he worked himself into what they called a fit of madness. He became so depressed and despondent that he attempted suicide. As a matter of fact, over many years, he attempted suicide multiple times, at least four. Overdosing on laudanum, attempting to hang himself, and it seems that some of the failed attempts, it was miraculous. Obviously, God was not ready for him to go because his attempts at suicide repeatedly failed. And tragically, when he would come to himself, he would feel horrific guilt for attempting this sin of self-murder. And then he would wonder if it was possible that he could be forgiven and would think himself maybe despised of God. He wrote, quote, "Conviction of sin took place, especially of that just committed. The meanness of it, as well as its atrocity, were exhibited to me in colors so inconceivably strong that I despised myself with a contempt not to be imagined or expressed. The sense of it secured from me the repetition of a crime which I could not now reflect on without abhorrence, a sense of God's wrath and a deep despair of ever escaping it instantly succeeded." From the biographical material I read, I'm convinced that were William Cooper alive today, he would be diagnosed and medicated. He clearly had some sort of a major depressive disorder. He spoke of years of time when his mental outlook, quote, took the place of a man who had just arrived at the place of execution. Many years after it happened, he wrote of his first depressive episode, one of these fits of madness, quote, "I was struck with such a dejection of spirits as none but they who have felt the same can have the least conception of. Day and night I was upon the rack, lying down in horror and rising up in despair. I presently lost all relish for those studies to which I had been so closely attached. The classics no longer had any charms for me. I had need of something more salutary than amusement, but I had no one to direct me where to find it." Sad. In December of 1763, he was committed to St. Albans Insane Asylum, where a 58-year-old Christian doctor, Dr. Nathaniel Cotton, tended to afflicted patients. And the doctor was somewhat of a poet. And the doctor was an evangelical believer and a lover of God and the gospel. And he befriended William Cooper deeply and held out hope to him repeatedly in spite of Cooper's insistence that he was damned and beyond hope. 6 months into his stay at the insane asylum, Cooper found a Bible lying on a bench in the garden. Accident. And Cooper wrote, quote, "Having found a Bible on the bench in the garden, I opened upon the 11th of St. John, where Lazarus is raised from the dead, and saw so much benevolence, so much mercy, goodness, and sympathy with miserable men in our Savior's conduct, that I almost shed tears upon the relation, little thinking that it was an exact type of the mercy which Jesus was on the point of extending towards myself. I sighed and said, oh, that I had not rejected so good a Redeemer. Oh, that I had not forfeited all His favors. Thus was my heart softened, though not yet enlightened." But he seemed to begin to increasingly feel that he was not utterly doomed. And he wrote of a time when, quote, "I turned again to the Bible, and the first verse that he saw was Romans 3:25, whom God hath set forth to be a propitiation through faith in His blood, to declare His righteousness for the remission of sins that are past through the forbearance of God." And he wrote, "Immediately I received the strength to believe this, and the full beams of the Son of Righteousness shone upon me. I saw the sufficiency of the atonement that He had made. I saw my pardon sealed in His blood and all the fullness and completeness of His justification. In a moment, I believed and received the gospel in all its clearness with demonstration of the Spirit and power. Unless the Almighty arm had been under me, I think I would have died there with gratitude and joy. My eyes filled with tears and my voice choked with transport. I could only look up to heaven in silent fear, overwhelmed with love and wonder." So, after quite a while in the asylum and much fellowship with Dr. Cotton, his grip on rationality seemed to return. And he moved to the small country town of Olney, where John Newton, the ex-slave trader, was the pastor. And like William Cooper, John Newton had lost his mother when he was six, but he had a much different life. He had a beautiful relationship with his father. He got into the slave trade with his father as they sailed all around the world. You may have read of Newton's powerful conversion from slave trader to Christian, pastor and hymn writer. And we know him mainly as the author of Amazing Grace, but John Newton was a beloved and happy pastor, 18th century pastor, a man, a deep man with a great love for people. Newton became Cooper's pastor, and he loved him deeply. He was very concerned about Cooper's depression and became his close friend. He tried to involve Cooper in ministerial activities and opportunities, and together they would take long walks in the country between the homes of parishioners that he was going to visit. And he would take Cooper along with him, and they would visit and talk about God and the purposes of God and God's purpose for the church on these long walks together. And it seems like Newton was always trying to uplift and help him. They were both poetical, both poets. And so in 1769, Newton suggested that they collaborate on a book of hymns to be sung in their church there in Olney. And Newton thought it would be a good thing, probably thought it would be therapeutic for Cooper's poetic bent to be engaged. And in the end, Newton wrote about 208 hymns, poems, and Cooper wrote 68. And I have the Olney Hymns PDF on my desktop. You can go to ccel.org and download it for free. It's called the Olney Hymns. They published their own hymn book for their church. It was published in 1779. And besides having Newton's amazing grace, it has God moves in a mysterious way, which I quoted to you from earlier. There is a fountain filled with blood. We have five of Cooper's hymns in our hymn book, and we sing all of them. Whatever the mental illness was that William Cooper had, it seems to have been cyclical, because he had episodes about every 10 years over 40 years, four major depressive episodes. There were repeated attempts at suicide, but each time God providentially prevented him, and John Newton stood by him through all of this, even sacrificing vacation time to stay home when it appeared that Cooper was having one of his episodes. Newton wanted to be there for him. In 1780, John Newton moved to London to pastor a church there, and he served there the next 27 years. But he didn't abandon his friendship with William Cooper. And there's an earnest exchange of letters between them for about 20 years. It seems that Cooper could pour out his heart to Newton more than ever than anyone else. The publication of the Olney hymn, the hymn book, that was sort of Cooper's first introduction to the wider literary world. He was relatively unknown before that, but he became sort of a poetic rock star after that. And he's considered one of the founders of the English Romantic movement. And some would say maybe it was a good thing for Newton to go away, because when he left, Cooper poured himself into major poetic projects between 1780 and 1786 and was quite prolific. And I mentioned poetry that was reviewed by Benjamin Franklin. And I want to read you one of Cooper's poems, probably influenced by his relationship with John Newton, the former slave trader, but now pastor. And it's called The Negro's Complaint. Some of you may have heard it, but listen. The Negro's Complaint. Forced from home and all its pleasures, Afric's coast I left forlorn, to increase a stranger's treasures, or the raging billows born. Men from England bought and sold me, paid my price in paltry gold, but though slave they have enrolled me, mines are never to be sold. Still in thought, as free as ever, what are England's rights, I ask? Me from my delights to sever? Me to torture? Me to task? Fleecy locks and black complexion cannot forfeit nature's claim. Skins may differ, but affection dwells in white and black the same. Why did all creating nature make the plant for which we toil? Sighs must fan it, tears must water, sweat of ours must dress the soil. Think, ye masters, iron-hearted, lolling at your jovial boards, think how many backs have smarted for your sweets, for the sweets your cane affords. Is there, as you sometimes tell us, is there one who reigns on high? Has he bid you buy and sell us, speaking from his throne, the sky? Ask him if your knotted scourges, matches, blood-extorting screws, are the means that duty urges, agents of his will to use? Hark! He answers, wild tornadoes strewing yonder sea with wrecks, wasting towns, plantations, meadows, are the voice with which he speaks. He, foreseeing what vexations Afric's son should undergo, fixed their tyrant's habitations, where his whirlwinds answer, no. By our blood in Afric wasted, ere our necks received the chain, by the miseries we tasted, crossing in your barks the main, by our sufferings since you brought us to the man-degrading mart, all sustained by patience taught us, only by a broken heart. Deem our nation brutes no longer, till some reason you shall find, worthier of regard and stronger than the color of our kind. Slaves of gold, whose sordid dealings tarnish all your boasted powers, prove that you have human feelings ere you proudly question ours. The Negro's complaint. Powerful stuff. Well, John Newton remained William Cooper's pastor and friend for the rest of his life, writing and visiting him again and again and again and again. And Newton did not despair of Cooper's despairing. And after one of those visits in 1788, Cooper wrote him, "I found those comforts in your visit, which have formerly sweetened all our interviews, in part restored. I knew you for the same shepherd who was sent to lead me out of the wilderness into the pasture where the chief shepherd feeds his flock, and felt my sentiments of affectionate friendship for you the same as ever. But one thing was still wanting, and that the crown of all. I shall find it in God's time, if it be not lost forever." Well, saints, preparing this biographical sketch made me more thankful than ever, maybe, for soundness of mind. And I want to remind you that a sound mind is from the Lord. And if you have a sound mind, you should thank God for it. And also, I want to remind you of an apostolic command that is given to us. Comfort the feeble-minded. 1 Thessalonians 5:14. Comfort the feeble-minded. The English Standard Version translates it, encourage the faint-hearted. A sound mind is from the Lord. Brother William Cooper. Well, observations or comments? Thoughts? God can bring forth His truth out of the mouth of Balaam's donkey. He can bring forth His praise out of the mouth of sucklings and infants. He can bring forth glory and honor and praise after from one whose mind is tortured. Blessed be His name. I think on the ones that are in our books, it's a different, sometimes it's the same person. Right. I think they're different.